From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, July 23rd is the Rastafarian celebration of the birthday of Emperor Haile Selassie. On Sunday, Mormons mark Pioneer Day, and Monday is the Christian St. James the Great Day. As the drama of the Republican National Convention unfolded in Cleveland this past week, we served up daily interviews with diverse voices from across the political spectrum. On this week's State of Belief Radio, you'll hear highlights of those conversations. To watch videos of the week's coverage in full, I invite you to visit stateofbelief.com. Among the guests we featured are Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, and we'll hear part of those conversations later in the hour. I'll also talk to Peter Montgomery of People for the American Way, who kept up a remarkable stream of tweets and online posts even as he wandered both the convention and some of the events happening at the fringes of it. Photojournalist Zach Roberts reported from the thick of it as our liberal on the convention floor. And leading conservative voices added invaluable insights to our understanding of this unprecedented political event as well. Later in this week's show, you'll hear highlights of my conversations with Noam Neusner, James Robbins, and Audrey Mullins. But we'll start with Greg LaBelle, assistant professor of political management at George Washington University and the veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg has been incredibly generous with his time whenever we're covering electoral politics, and this past week was no exception.
Okay, Greg, was the Melania speech kerfuffle anything to talk about, or should we just move on from that?
I think what's more important is what happened after the speech than the speech itself. It raises one question. Are there any adults in the room over there who are sort of looking at these things and making decisions? The other question I think we have to think about is, what does this say about Donald Trump and crisis management, as you will? I mean, they bungled this thing from the time the first comments came out about the similarities to Michelle Obama's speech. This is just more of that same kind of doubling down, not responding, refusing to just move on beyond something. They could have put this to bed early.
What did you hear from the convention stage today that particularly caught your attention?
Hillary's a liar.
You know, I've heard that over and over and over, yeah. And I've heard how much they hate Hillary.
Yeah.
I haven't heard much about policy, program, positives.
No, we haven't. This was Make America Work Again. I didn't hear any discussion of economics, about jobs. There was no plan. There was nothing there. And frankly, like last night, I think these themes don't seem to really mean anything. So the question is, why are they there? Are they bungling it, or did they just make up these themes and had no intention of having any connection? Because that's not what we heard tonight. I guess the couple of the speeches that stood out were, I think that Chris Christie's speech stood out. It was sort of a cheap trick that you often see at conventions, you know, the sort of call and response thing. But it was all about Hillary Clinton, and it was certainly not about jobs or the economy or anything. The other one, and I think they're probably the high points of the night, were the two Trump kids, Tiffany and Donald Jr. They did what Melania Trump should have done last night in terms of smoothing some of the edges on the candidate. But again, nothing that had anything to do with the theme. So why do they even have them? It's what I'm trying to figure out. And the other question is, when are they going to start trying to broaden the base? Both nights seem to me to have been directed toward the folks, pretty much the folks who are already on board, or at least the people in the room. they know that they need to broaden the base if they're going to win. We finished second night. There doesn't seem to have been any attempt to do that. This is red meat stuff to the folks who are either true believers or the pragmatists who've just said, you know, okay, we got to go along with this. But this convention is introducing or reintroducing this guy to the American public, and I don't see it going well.
Greg, do you think some Democrats are not taking seriously enough the emotional appeal of some of the speakers at the GOP convention? We were critical of the dark tone when we spoke yesterday, but an awful lot of conservatives seem to be just eating that up.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the Democrats not taking this seriously in a sort of a broader sense than just the convention. I'm not sure how the convention will fare with Democrats or even independents, but I do worry that Democrats are maybe not taking the threat of this candidacy as seriously as they should. I think there is potential for Donald Trump to win this thing if Democrats don't take this seriously. I almost have a sort of an opposite view of the convention. You hear the same thing so many times over and over again. I wonder if viewers at home are literally or figuratively turning it off. I mean, how many times can you say Hillary Clinton is a liar and you know, the great chant for tonight, lock her up, lock her up? I wonder how that's we won't know for a little bit yet in terms of bump and polling and so on. But I wonder how that's playing in the living rooms across the United States. It may not play all that well.
We've just finished listening to Donald Trump give his address for the evening. Greg, what did we just hear?
What didn't we just hear? Well, you know, I sat there and I tried to figure out thematically what was going on. And the best I can come up with is, you know, this is a dark and miserable and frightening and horrific world. And the only thing that stands where you're all getting screwed and the only thing that stands between you and that is me, Donald Trump.
Well, tell me what got your attention the most.
Well, I guess to start with, what got my attention even before his speech was Ivanka's introduction, where she started talking about equal pay for equal work, some things that I thought are odd things to be hearing about at a Republican convention. Then when Trump took the stage, I guess talking about LGBTQ issues in that crowd and getting to the extent I could tell, the sort of reaction he got, his comment about the Johnson Amendment, about talking about politics from the pulpit, it's like there was just stuff sort of flying so fast. It was very difficult to sort of follow all of it. But those are two things that jumped out at me.
After hearing that tonight in the convention speech, do you see fear of a Trump presidency as potentially motivating the Democrats?
I would expect the answer to that is yes. I think that's been there already. I think that he reinforced many of the concerns about what a Trump presidency would look like. And not just the list of issues like immigration and so on and so forth. And again, the approach, that sense that I'm the only thing that stands between you and utter destruction. That came across so clearly. Even the way he talked, you know, he said on January 20th, 2017, these things will happen immediately. That shows, first of all, a lack of understanding of how the process works, but secondly, a really inflated view, I think, of what he can do.
Do you think the way the RNC went will influence anything about how the Democrats nominate their candidate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the way it works is that the party that holds the White House gets to go second. There is a certain benefit to that because they get a chance to see what the other side is doing. And I know they've been watching very closely. That will influence what happens next week. I'm sure they've been doing that all week. You're going to see in many ways the Democratic Convention responding to what happened this week in Cleveland.
Well, those are some highlights from my conversations this week with Greg LaBelle, who will be joining me in Philadelphia this coming week for our comprehensive coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Journalist Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way, was all over the internet this week chronicling some of the most extreme and religiously oriented activity in and around the Republican National Convention. Here are some excerpts from our time together this week.
So, Peter, what did you witness in Cleveland today?
Well, I spent quite a few hours at the rally put on by radio conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and political dirty trickster Roger Stone. So that was quite an event.
Was the Alex Jones event just a fringe thing, or did it attract a significant number of delegates?
I would say it's pretty much of a fringe thing, except that, you know, these days it's really hard to tell the fringe from the rest of the party, given the fact that Donald Trump has embraced Alex Jones and has gone on his radio show. So we had Jones and Roger Stone. We had a couple of, political candidates. And I was a little surprised how many people at this Alex Jones rally told us that Trump loves the Lord and he's going to bring God back into the country.
What was the general mood before they started the convention?
I don't know how many people were aware of this challenge that was going to happen, that folks were going to try to force a roll call vote on the rules. I think it was a misstep by the party leaders that they sort of shut that down in a very bending the rules show of force, when they could have let the vote happen and they would have won the vote by a large margin, I think. And instead, they created chaos and a lot of hard feelings and made it look like they weren't really willing to play by the rules.
There were lots of protests and lots of criticism about how that was handled and how poorly it was handled, and the fact that it was just a brute kind of, here's what the decision is, whether or not that was what it should be or not. Did you see any protest out today? And I'm wondering if what you heard after the start of the convention, if anything, about the anger that was obvious in the room.
Well, I think that the anger was obvious, and I think people like, really conservative people like Mike Lee and Ken Cuccinelli, who I consider really at the part of the far right of the party, they were really offended at the way the party was acting. But I think it was a perfect sign of what is to come, because the party is taking on the persona of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is not about playing by the rules. Donald Trump is all about showing strength. So I think that that was what Trump wanted, and I think the party is taking on the Trump persona. And I think that that is what some of these never-Trump people, it's why they've been fighting to the end, because some of these people who are very conservative, and I would disagree with them politically on just about everything, but I've really developed some respect for the fact that some of them just are not willing to go along silently and see the party just trash its own principles in order to embrace this charlatan.
What was the mood tonight? Was it all hoorays? Were there some people not so much into it? What did you see and hear as the speech was being given?
I think for the bulk of the people here who are on the Trump train, you know, the night was exciting for them. And, you know, I was appalled that on a night when the supposed theme was Make America One Again, that on a night with that as the theme, we had the Pledge of Allegiance given by Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, who certainly has a lot of Americans he doesn't consider as part of the one. And we had Sheriff Joe Arpaio honored with a speaking role on the platform, you know, not to mention Trump himself and his speech. But, you know, well, there was the most disturbing thing I've been to all week was this Gays for Trump party that was this bizarre party in which we had gay people and their allies talking about in the name of freedom, chanting in favor of fascist politicians from the Netherlands who wants to ban the Quran and ban mosques and get rid of Muslims and sort of very hardcore religious division and exclusion was being promoted at the conservative Trump case for Trump party. So as a progressive gay man, I found that a really disturbing thing to experience.
Well, those are some highlights of my conversations this week with Peter Montgomery, associate editor at Religion Dispatches and senior fellow at People for the American Way. We also heard from photojournalist Zach Roberts, who described the experience of attending a Donald Trump rally a few weeks ago on the show. Zach spent the week covering events in Cleveland and described how the convention differed and didn't differ from those notorious rallies.
It had a lot of the same vibe. There was, a lot of the weird kind of call and repeat stuff that Trump does. Chris Christie had a call and repeat where he made judgments of Hillary Clinton as whether she was guilty or not. And the ball drop was larger than anything I've ever seen, at least on TV and at a convention. The fact that literally we were about waist high in balloons and confetti, at least as I will say, first as press, it was kind of the first time that it wasn't at a Trump event because he didn't do the usual everybody point and look at the members of the press and call them liars and cheats. But the tone in the room whenever even Trump tonight spoke about LGBT rights, there was certainly a muted, uncomfortable moment. He immediately said, thank you for applauding the LGBT community or something along those lines, which, they kind of didn't. That was not the tone in the room.
We also asked Zach what he experienced on the floor of the convention that mainstream media coverage of the event seemed to miss.
At Trump rallies, one of the things that he constantly says is, they always show the close-up shot. They don't show the audience, and they don't show the crowd. It's like, well, we can't show the crowd because we're, fitted behind them. But if we did show the crowds, we would see a crowd that, first off, didn't look much like America on breakdown. It's very white, very male, very aggressive. And the biggest thing is the moments that the audience responds to in Trump's speeches. When he calls for differences in trade policy, differences in different things, and we can all discuss that. But when he talks about, things like certain racial groups being different and kind of pointing those people out, that's when those crowds get really, really worked up and they get faces of hatred that you hope that was long gone in America. But something about Trump and the way that he talks, the way that he copies the Mussolini style, maybe mobster look, he steps back from the podium, uses his hands wide. And those are the moments that really kind of, we don't see the crowd that's on the convention floor. It's not the crowd that shows up. I think I spoke to you after I went to a Cleveland rally for Donald Trump, and that's a very different crowd than the crowd that's on the floor here. Half of these people are, probably dignitaries. I was sitting 1 foot away from two congressmen from the state of Pennsylvania and the governor of Pennsylvania, and 100 feet away from the New York delegation with Rudy Giuliani. And so it's a very different crowd here, but it's still something that he is able to bring out in people that even whatever you want to say about Romney, whatever you want to say about Bush, Bush never did that. Bush never called out, Muslim groups. He reached out to Muslim groups. He doesn't work with people. He said, you can take it or leave it. And well, that's not really the rules of democracy.
Some firsthand impressions from photojournalist Zach Roberts, who spent the week covering the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Our week-long coverage of the Republican National Convention included conversations with some leading conservative voices. Here are some excerpts.
I'm joined by Dr. James Robbins, conservative commentator, author, and educator. He writes for USA Today and is a contributing editor for National Review Online, as well as a senior fellow for National Security Affairs on the American Foreign Policy Council. Jim, the theme for day one of the GOP convention was Make America Safe Again. How do you see Donald Trump's rhetoric of strength resonating with voters who are frightened by so many crises, both at home and overseas?
Well, I think that his message has been consistent, and the events have conspired in his favor. The continuing terror attacks domestically and overseas, not to mention some of the domestic problems with people attacking law enforcement and other violence of that nature, have all tended to make people focus on this message that he had already been talking about. So in a way, it makes him look like he was ahead of the curve.
Well, it's a fact that we are in the midst of another stretch of violence in our streets, as well as violence overseas, even as the convention convened. Can Donald Trump have an impact on this as a candidate, or is that really only something he can affect if he wins the election in November?
I think he could affect it in terms of the debate, to the extent that his campaign is setting itself up as a law and order campaign. I think pushing ahead that vision is a way that he can have an impact. I don't think that that would have any substantive impact. Obviously, he's not changing the way police are trained or keeping people from protesting or, you know, doing other things. But it definitely serves as a point of reference in the debate, and it guarantees that that point of reference will be prominent in the media.
Mm-hmm. I'm joined now by Audrey Mullen, former executive director of American Tax Reform. She is a partner in Advocacy Inc., public relations firm in Washington, D.C. I'd be interested in your opinion of the strategy of having so many members of Donald Trump's family speaking at this year's convention.
I don't work for the Trump campaign. I have no insights into what their plans are. But, I mean, I think it's clear that they are aware that he is only seen as a business person. He is not seen as a family man or somebody that people may be able to relate to on a personal level. And so they're trying to personalize him. And, you know, and that's always a good strategy. I think that worked well. Certainly people thought that Mitt Romney was a decent family man and had a, you know, lovely family, and they were all very nice and all of that. But I don't know how well it will work, and I am kind of alarmed that they have a speechwriter for Melania Trump who appears to have been cribbing something, although, in all honesty, most candidates' wives give that speech that their husband is a great guy, a true patriot. It was really apparent to me on the first date how much he loved America, and, you know, I've never heard of a candidate's wife saying, you know, I look at this guy, and I think my mother, she was right. I could do better. I could do better. So could you, America.
Is there something you would like to see party leadership doing at the convention that they're not doing, at least not yet?
Look, I supported other candidates earlier in this process. I am very aware of a lot of dissent among delegates. And I don't think that there are enough to dump Trump as a candidate. But I do think that it is a bad idea for the party to not allow delegates to have an open vote, to present a petition calling for votes on various items to different platforms, to the chair. And I think that squelching these efforts, you know, in the name of preserving harmony, is only going to fuel dissent amongst those people who feel that they are not being heard. Now, I don't necessarily support them or anything that they want to do, but I do believe that, you know, all of the delegates deserve to participate in an open and transparent process, that the game shouldn't be rigged in any way. You see a lot of that in this election, that people feel that they are not being heard, that they are not being listened to by those who matter, and they are turning away to alternative candidates. They're frustrated with their parties, and, you know, this is not helping.
Some commentators are saying that Republican leaders like Paul Ryan have come to support Donald Trump in public, but that they're deeply concerned in private. Obviously, Hillary Clinton has a similar problem with many Democratic leaders. How much of what you're seeing is real enthusiasm, or how much of it is pragmatic enthusiasm to put forward a good look for those looking in?
Look, I think that the only lack of enthusiasm you might see is on the part of corporations that have pulled out and that they're not sponsoring parties and events as they might have for other potential nominees, simply because they're afraid of any negative PR fallout. However, people are here because I believe that the overwhelming majority are going to support Trump. And I think it is incumbent upon party leaders to support their nominee publicly. And if they have, issues, they should address them privately and present a united front until the election day. And then they can, Monday morning quarterback all they want. Once somebody is a nominee, it's just not becoming for party leaders to continue complaining. I mean, they can, get on board or be quiet.
I'm joined by Noam Neusner, who served as a speechwriter for George W. Bush and is a co-founder of 30 Point Strategies, LLC. How powerful do you think the image of Donald Trump as a business genius is in perhaps distracting his supporters from thinking more deeply about fiscal issues and the way federal policies affect them personally?
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. I mean, the whole idea of how Americans feel about work and prosperity and opportunity, let's set aside Mr. Trump's biography for a second, and even his policies, because frankly, I think they're not necessarily equal to the issue. But I think people of a variety of viewpoints, conservative, liberal, and everything in between, fully recognize that America has an opportunity gap. And some would say we have an income gap, a wealth gap. I'd prefer to call it an opportunity gap, but I think it's a variation on the same theme. There's a lot of people who are doing pretty well, and they've done spectacularly well under President Obama, rising stock market wealth, rising housing wealth, huge opportunities on the coast. It's a really terrific few years for them. But a significant share of the country is not experiencing that opportunity. It's not experiencing that prosperity. And these are wage earners. These are not people who necessarily lock a lot of their income from the stock market. They work paycheck to paycheck. They live paycheck to paycheck. They struggle with a lot of the day-to-days that wealthier people don't really worry about. And so the theme of make America work again, get America working again, that actually is a real good theme. I think it's actually pretty resonant, and it explains to a certain extent the appeal that Trump has enjoyed with people who feel left out of the prosperity that America has experienced in the last few years. Now, Mr. Trump's got a biography problem. He's somebody who, first of all, he's at least claims to be very wealthy, and so therefore it's hard to imagine him having a lot of empathy for people who don't have wealth. But that was an issue with Roosevelt. It wasn't an issue with John Kennedy. It wasn't a trouble with a lot of politicians who have done a great job serving people of low wealth. So the question is, well, what about his bankruptcies? What about his business failures? What about all that? I don't know. I don't think any of that really has resonated with people who you think would be particularly sensitive to it. Mm-hmm. There seems to be something else that's appealing about Trump and his business acumen, such as it is, for voters who are frustrated. And I don't think that they're paying attention to those kinds of details. The facts speak for themselves. Right now, Mr. Trump is benefiting dramatically from his appeal to people who feel left out.
I'm wondering, as a lifelong communications professional, how you would explain the way Donald Trump connects with his audiences. I see him breaking all of the rules, and yet it seems to work for him.
Yeah, I think that actually that may be his appeal, that he's breaking all of the rules. I read a very, very powerful essay, and basically it looks at the problem that you're seeing among people who really feel left behind America's prosperity. It was a piece by a guy named Chris Arnade, A-R-N-A-D-E. It's on Medium.com. The key point that Arnade points out is that when you are sitting on the end of America's socioeconomic spectrum, where you are left out, where you're feeling like people are passing you by, where you're not valued, not just economically, but socially, where being on a lower end of the spectrum means that you have no worth, you kind of don't really care about the rules. You don't mind basically breaking all the rules, breaking up all the institutions that you hold responsible for your own situation. When you look at Michelle Obama's speech in 08, she actually talks about this a little bit. She talks about how poverty in America, poor people are not treated to have any value, whereas in other societies they sometimes are. It's a powerful point, and Trump seems to be tapping into that. Maybe it's because he basically doesn't care what the institutional elites think. That is a signal. He's like, look, I don't care. And if you're somebody who also doesn't care what the institutional elites think, you culturally feel like he gets you. And he gets you in a way that no other politician possibly can, because, let's face it, he's not a politician.
As part of our week-long coverage of the GOP convention, I spoke daily with Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, and here's some of what he had to say.
Before I give you my immediate thoughts, I have to make clear to our viewers and listeners that we are a 501c3 organization. If I'm talking about the Republicans today, it's only because they're in the news, not because I'm implying any endorsement or criticism of any candidate. So now that I've got that disclaimer out of the way, I can try to be honest. I was really concerned yesterday, I have to tell you, for Muslims and other religious minorities in this country. I don't think there was a speaker who didn't point a finger at their religious tradition and some of the people that they themselves are embarrassed about, that has to be casting a pall over the heart of every parent of a Muslim child who has to send him or her out into the playground or the schoolyard over the coming months. And it wasn't just the Muslims. In spite of some vague attempts to reassure the rest of us who are parts of minorities in this country, the attacks on what Representative King called the subgroups of America were very, very alarming. That was coupled with the remarks by Pastor Burns from South Carolina, who called Hillary Clinton an enemy in the name of God. And that was alarming to me. Yeah. So yesterday was a troubling day, I think, for people who consider themselves to be part of any religious minority. Today, I have to tell you, I heard the intellectual life of any educated American dismantled by speaker after speaker. The disparagement that was heaped upon people who've gone to the trouble to get an education, to read a book, to think about something, was very distressing to me. And to hear those sentiments cheered by the Republican Party, which has a proud history of intellectualism going all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, was very, very distressing to me.
What else about religion have you seen that you either were pleased with or very displeased with?
I was pleased to see that there was at least an attempt to bring in people from different faith traditions who, except for the one unfortunate example that I've mentioned, took great pains to be both inclusive and appropriate. There is a place for religious expression in a political convention, and it is to remind people of their better natures and the better values of what they are, what they're there to do, which is to lift up this country and to propose a candidate and a set of values that will guide it for the next number of years. So that part of it was very encouraging to me. Unfortunately, in between some lovely prayers, benedictions, and invocations, there was an awful lot of cheerleading for a particular brand of Christianity. Speaker after speaker got up and proclaimed a faith in Jesus and asked essentially for affirmation from the 4,700 delegates who were there. If the Republican Party is as diverse as they like to claim it is, there was a disconnect there.
I see. Yes. I'm curious as to what you thought about the speakers tonight. I'm particularly interested in what you thought about Ben Carson's speech.
Dr. Carson criticized Secretary Clinton for considering Saul Alinsky a mentor. And the justification he gave for that is that in Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals, the dedication page includes a dedication to Lucifer, the original rebel. Mr. Carson then went to great pains to associate Hillary Clinton with Lucifer, with the devil, and to claim that this is a country that is based on God and godliness, and that the choices are clear. We're either going to follow the path that our founders sent us down, one nation under God, or we're going to go to the godless, satanic nominee from the other party. I was absolutely horrified.
In watching all of this, what has flashed through your mind in relation to Interfaith Alliance and its programs and has made you say, oh, we've got to be sure we keep on top of this?
I think, Welton, what you articulated well during your tenure as the healing power of religion is going to be all the more important as we move forward. It doesn't matter what the outcome of this election is going to be. There are going to be a lot of injured souls in this country. And we, through our advocacy for the Constitution, for the principles of free exercise and the rejection of the establishment of any particular religious tradition, we have to be in the forefront of healing this nation from what is sure to be a brutal campaign.
Jack, it's over. What stood out for you on this final session of the convention?
That Mr. Trump spoke for a very long time and said very little. He did it very well, I have to say. But I had really, really hoped, as I have been hoping through this entire campaign, to hear him talk about some specific proposals for policy. And as far as I could tell, he only had two. One was to dismantle our trade system, about which Interfaith Alliance has nothing to say. And the other is to repeal the Johnson Rule, which prevents pastors, rabbis, imams from endorsing candidates from the pulpit. And to that, I will object loudly and strongly. Most people are under the misconception that pastors and other religious officials can't participate in public campaigning. That's absolutely not true. What the IRS regulations, not the law, but the IRS regulations demand is that when they are in the pulpit and when they're representing their house of worship, they stay free of partisan advocacy. And that is to protect both the political system from the kind of abuses we heard from Pastor Mark Burns on the first night of the convention. And I think more importantly, it is to protect houses of worship from the intrusion of government and political figures. You actually heard Mr. Trump illustrate my point tonight when he thanked the evangelicals for their support, even though he didn't deserve it, as he said. And what this means, if that rule is repealed, is that pastors will feel free to pander to, cater to the candidate of their choice, and their parishioners will suffer if that candidate loses, and others will suffer if that candidate wins. I can't think of anything worse for the faith community in the United States.
What will you be listening for from the Democrats?
Well, selfishly, I'm going to be listening for a little more emphasis on First Amendment guarantees, and particularly true religious freedom guarantees, than I've been hearing from the Democrats of late. I'm not willing to cede to the Republicans, or more appropriately, I think, to the religious right, a misinterpretation of what constitutes religious freedom in this country. And I'm going to be looking for individuals who will stand up for freedom of conscience and for the guarantees of the Constitution, which are not mutually exclusive.
There's some of what I talked about with Jack Moline during the course of this past week as Republicans gathered in Cleveland to nominate Donald J. Trump, their candidate for President of the United States. Come on, let's make America great, make America great again. Come on, let's make. Now, before we go, a few thoughts of my own. Hyperbole is the word that comes to my mind first. I've been fascinated with and an observer of the two major political parties nominating conventions since late childhood. The drama of those conventions gripped me, and the wild celebrations in them intrigued me. Speakers always employed hyperbole to get attention and garner applause. I enjoyed watching democracy at work. That was not the case this past week. Hyperbole was still there. In every session of the gathering in Cleveland, I felt uneasy, on edge, suspicious, and generally questioning what was happening. Early into Friday morning, after the closing gavel had come down on the RNC, I tried to identify the major messages of the week. There were two, as I see it. The first message was that Hillary Clinton is a bad, bad person who is responsible for virtually everything that's gone wrong in foreign affairs since at least her time in the United States Senate. The bothersome chant of the week that resounded repeatedly through the convention center related to Secretary Clinton, lock her up. Lock her up. At least two speakers charged Hillary Clinton with murder. And another said she deserves to be placed before a firing squad. Never, never had I heard that kind of talk from either party. The second message was, if you're not afraid and living in fear and anger, something is wrong with you. There was no indication that anything is right in our nation. The week was filled with ironies. The best speeches came from the presidential candidate's children, not from him. He applauded the amount of publicity that came from charges of plagiarism leveled at his wife. Indeed, the best of the best speeches came from Ivanka Trump, who said she was neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but a person who voted for candidates who had the best interest in this nation, in her opinion. The most unifying moment in the convention did not come from candidate Trump, but from the resentment-filled chorus of boos aimed at Ted Cruz because he didn't endorse the party's presidential nominee. The candidate himself kept repeatedly promising to tell us his vision and outline his policies for a better future, though he always quickly transitioned back to denunciations of Hillary Clinton. I have to say Donald Trump was on his best behavior. He made it clear that he has two different personalities. This week we saw the kinder, gentler Trump, who let people know he already has changed his mind related to immigration. No longer did he claim that Mexico would foot the bill for the wall he wants to build. And no longer did he base his fears related to immigration on the back of one religion. Over the long haul of the general election before us, we will have to determine which Donald Trump would sit in the White House if he is elected president. Yes, religion took some hits during the week. A clearly sectarian and disgustingly partisan prayer calling on God to help Republicans win the election. A policy endorsement that would allow houses of worship to endorse political candidates for public office and thus divide their congregations and change the landscape of religion in America. And expressions of gratitude for leaders of the religious right who have done more harm to religion and democracy than any other group in our nation over the past 25 years. So where are we right now? Nothing happened this past week to help bring the nation together. Fears were heightened, and the strategy for addressing fear was to cause more fear. We learned nothing new. The people who supported Hillary Clinton likely still do. The same is true for backers of Donald Trump. The outcome of the 2016 presidential election will be determined by voters who do not like either candidate, but in desperation decide that one is worse than the other. My hope is that those who decide the identity of the new president will make their decisions not on the basis of staunch party affiliation and not on the basis of emotions. Responsible voters think clearly and cast ballots forged by rational judgments. Perhaps my words today are too negative. I hope that's not the case. I think the RNC's convention meant for us to feel worse. I know it's weird, but the source of my negativism this morning is a positivism about the nation I love. I am not a Pollyanna. I look straight into the face of reality. But you know what? I think our nation, though far from perfect, is great already. I refuse to applaud an election that suggests only one person can make this nation great. As I first came to believe all those years ago, that responsibility belongs to each of us, all of us. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Next week, we're heading to Philadelphia to bring you daily coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.